From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's been a quarter century since the Iowa Lottery was launched. Over the past 25 years, the lottery has awarded billions of dollars in prizes for winners and become a vital source of proceeds for the state. We'll look back at its development with Mary Neubauer of the Iowa Lottery. Then in our second half hour, while immigration is a hot topic in Arizona and other states, a film by a Drake University professor premiering next month on the Documentary Channel focuses on the impact of immigration in one Iowa community. We'll talk with Jody Swilke about his film, A Little Salsa on the Prairie, The Changing Character of Perry, Iowa. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was 25 years ago, on August 22, 1985, that Iowa lottery sales began, with a kickoff celebration at the Iowa State Fair. And to mark the lottery's silver anniversary, we want to look back at this venture that has produced billions of dollars in prizes for winners and proceeds for a host of state causes. 25 years after the first Iowa lottery tickets were sold, Iowa lottery sales now total some $4.8 billion. $2.6 billion has been won by Iowa lottery players. $1.2 billion in lottery proceeds has gone to Iowa causes. But the lottery is not without its controversies and problems. Touch Play, for instance. Joining us to look back at the Iowa Lottery's 25-year history and to look into what the lottery may have planned for the future, Mary Neubauer, Vice President for External Relations at the Iowa Lottery. Good afternoon to you, Mary.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thanks so much for having me on today.
We'll get your mic turned up there. Great to have you with us this afternoon. Hearing you faintly in the background, but I want to remind our listeners that we'd like to have you join our conversation as well. Do you play the Iowa Lottery? Tell us why. How often do you win? Have you ever won it big? Would you like to tell us about that? Or what concerns do you have about the lottery? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Well, Mary, I mentioned a few lottery numbers. I hope you're there in better volume now. Give us a little more in-depth picture of the role that the Iowa Lottery has developed in Iowa over the past quarter century.
Well, let's see how my sound is doing now. Am I still far away?
Well, you're a little bit better, but just go ahead. We can make it out. We'll try to improve it as you go along.
Okay, I'm moving up the food chain, as the saying goes. Well, you know, it's been interesting for those of us who work at the lottery to watch over time where the sales come from. You know, you had mentioned earlier that total lottery sales are $4.8 billion in the last quarter century. And, you know, when the lottery first started, a couple of our biggest selling regions in the state were up along the northern border and down along the western border, specifically down in the Council Bluffs area. And a lot of people would say, well, why is that? Those aren't necessarily the biggest population bases for the state. Well, it was because neither Nebraska nor Minnesota had lotteries at that time. So we were pulling in tons of sales from across the border, which was great for Iowa at that time.
And, of course, those states took notice of that, and they have had reacted since then.
Yes, they have.
Mary, I think we've lost you. Mary, we'll try to regain our contact with Mary Neubauer, Vice President for External Relations at the Iowa Lottery, as we look back at the silver anniversary of the Iowa Lottery. It's 25 years ago this summer that the first Iowa Lottery tickets were purchased. Tomorrow on this program, we're waiting to reestablish some contact with Mary Neubauer. Recently, the European Union freed its member states to make their own decisions on whether to grow genetically modified crops. Tomorrow on this program, we take up the latest on the debate over GMOs, genetically modified organisms, with James
Hello?
McWilliams. Hello?
Hello
there, Mary.
Hello.
Now we're hearing you fine.
Okay. Oh, equipment is not always our friend, is it?
No, it isn't. Everything has to be just so, but it sounds like everything is just so. Mary, you're hearing us fine?
Yes, I can hear you. And as long as you can hear me, that's all that matters.
Okay, we're good to go. Without any further delay, let's have you go into to the so you were talking about when we left off about how the in the beginning, the neighboring states, well, our borders with some of the neighboring states that didn't have lotteries were really the cash cows for the lottery.
Yeah, and it is interesting. And as you said, those other states definitely noticed what was going on. In 1990, Minnesota started its lottery, and then in 93, Nebraska started its lottery. So we're not getting those cross-border sales anymore. Those folks are staying at home and buying their lottery tickets and obviously keeping their dollars in those states. Today, you know, lottery sales in Iowa generally follow the population bases. Most of the top-selling retailers are in the Cedar Rapids area and in the Des Moines area, because those are two of the biggest population bases in the state. There's one store in Iowa that has stood out from the beginning of the Iowa lottery days. We laugh when we talk about this store because it doesn't really follow the population trend that we've been talking about. It's Quick Shop Foods in Ottumwa. You know, Ottumwa isn't one of the state's biggest cities, so you would be asking, well, why is that store so hot? Mm-hmm. Well, it's all about location, location, location. Just like in real estate, that store is right across the street from a John Deere plant down there. So Okay. Obviously a huge employment base down in southern Iowa. And when folks take their breaks or when they're on their way into work or on their way out of work, they stop at that convenience store to get a soda, get a snack, get whatever they would be buying. And they buy lottery tickets while they're there.
Do you hear of any businesses, any convenience stores, for example? I thought you were going this way with that, but that might be noted or seen as lucky, where there have been an overabundance of winners.
Yeah, you know, that title actually changes over time, and it has to do with where, you know, the latest big winning prize has been sold. The Tim and Kelly Guderian of Fort Dodge, who have won Iowa's biggest prize, bought their ticket at a convenience store up in Fort Dodge. And so that store has been known for a while as being lucky because they sold Iowa's biggest winning Powerball ticket to date. So
$200 million, wasn't that right?
I'd take it if somebody gave it to me. Yeah, 200. 200.8. You can't forget that 800,000. But yeah, so that lucky store title changes depending on where, you know, a big winning ticket has been sold.
Do you at the Iowa Lottery track anything about the big winners? This was in 2006 that that couple won that big lottery winning. Do you track what happens to the big winners, what they do with their winnings, how it changes their lives, any of that?
You know, across the country, there have been some reports, and it's one of those things where one bad report stands out more than a dozen good reports. You know, that happens in any industry. But across the country, there have been reports of people who have won the lottery and, you know, have burned through the money. I can tell you that in general, Iowa Lottery players have made really good decisions with their money. You see people, when they win even millions of dollars, talking about, you know, maybe refurbishing their house or buying a new car, but everybody mentions college education for the kids, putting money away for retirement. So we've had some really good winners here in Iowa. I will tell you that of late, because more and more people are choosing the cash option rather than the annuity, and that's certainly your choice. Mm-hmm. It is harder for us at the lottery to keep in contact with our winners because they come in, they get that big winning check, and then they're out the door, you know, and you may not ever talk to them again. Tim and Kelly Guderian still live in Fort Dodge. They have done a lot of really great things to help their community. They've given a lot of money to help build a new animal shelter up there, but they certainly have done a lot of really smart planning of their own too, as far as retirement savings go. So we do see people making some really good decisions with their money.
And I imagine when you win money on that order, all kinds of people descend on you asking for a little bit of that $200 million. Does Iowa Lottery give any advice to big winners? What to beware of?
You know, obviously we can't suggest a particular financial planning organization, but a couple of pieces of advice always come to mind that I tell the winners if I get a chance to talk to them before they come in with that ticket. Talk to a financial planner or a lawyer. This is a life-changing amount of money, and you do want to make sure that you make good decisions with the money. Another thing that I tell people, half jokingly and half not jokingly, is get an unlisted telephone number, because you're right, Ben. When people win millions of dollars, suddenly your third cousin five times removed that you've never talked to before is calling to say, hey, relative, how you doing? So that is something that people need to watch out for. Or, you know, if you win that amount of money, you can even consider hiring a service to go through your mail so you don't have to look at those, you know, requests that do come in for money. So there's certainly some good that comes along with winning that amount of money, but there's obviously a new level of responsibility, too, that you have to take into account.
Mary Neubauer with us on the Iowa Lottery, looking back over 25 years of the Iowa Lottery. And what can you say about the demographics of Iowa Lottery players? Do you track that as far as how many males, females, young, old, economic status?
Sure. In general, Iowa Lottery players are actually more female than male, which may surprise people. It's not a lot. It's still about 50-50, but it's a few percentages more for women than men. It may simply be that women are running more of the, you know, day-to-day family errands, so they would be the ones buying the tickets. It's not that the husband isn't playing or the, you know, the life partner isn't playing. It's simply that the woman might be the one actually making the purchase. But again, lottery players come from really the cross section of society. If you look at the demographics of Iowa, mm-hmm. that's who's playing, with the exception that you have to be 21 or older.
Well, okay. If I was the quintessential lottery player, I would be a little bit more female than male. How old would I be?
You would probably be predominantly in your 30s and 40s. Anywhere from 30 up to 60 is the biggest base of lottery players. And you would have some college education. You might not have graduated from college, but you would have some college education. And your median income would be probably in the $30,000 to $40,000 range are some mm-hmm. of the latest statistics. So again, it's just the average Iowan that you would meet on the street.
Any truth to the argument that people who can least afford it are the ones who shell out the money for lottery?
You know, I mean, obviously that's something that people like to say, but if you think about it from a business model, or even just from the perspective of how many tickets that were selling, you know, you talked about the lottery has sold $4.8 billion in tickets since it started in 1985. If someone is going to say that only the poor are playing, my answer would be, really? Do the poor people have $4.8 billion to spend on lottery tickets? And from a business model, it just doesn't make sense to build a business model where you would be aiming your product at people who can't afford to buy it. So, you know, it's certainly something that people say, but I don't think the statistics bear that out.
The Iowa Lottery is 25 years old. Nearly in a few days it will be. Mary Neubauer is with us, Vice President for External Relations at the Iowa Lottery. And Mary, hang on. We'll be back with you after a short break, and we want to reach out to our callers at that time. Do you play the Iowa Lottery? Tell us why. How often do you win? Have you ever won it big? What concerns do you have about the Iowa Lottery? Share those with us, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, I want to ask Mary about what these Iowa causes are, the $1.2 billion in proceeds that have gone to so-called Iowa causes. Details on that when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. 25 years after the first Iowa Lottery tickets were sold, Iowa Lottery sales now total nearly $5 billion. Joining us this afternoon for the remaining 10 minutes of this half hour, Mary Neubauer, Vice President for External Relations at the Iowa Lottery. Before we go to callers, I want to ask Mary, break down these Iowa causes. $1.2 billion over the last 25 years to Iowa causes. List off some of the areas that this money is going to benefit the state.
Sure. Well, you know, the money has gone different places through the years. When the lottery started in 1985, a lot of people will remember it was the height of the farm crisis here in Iowa and across the country. Lottery proceeds at that time went to economic development to help small businesses to try to drive job growth in the state. It was something called the Iowa Plan. Then for a time, lottery proceeds went to the environment, to natural resources. But today, lottery proceeds really have three uses. They provide support to veterans through the Iowa Veterans Trust Fund that goes directly to benefit our state's veterans and their families. It goes to the general fund to pay for all the programs that get their money through the general fund, be it education or law enforcement or agriculture. And it also is used as backup funding for the Vision Iowa program. And that obviously is the program that's built some community attractions across the state. And it's also building and repairing schools. So there are probably three main purposes for the money today, but it's been used in lots of different ways through the years.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Shane is joining us from Northwest Iowa. Hi, Shane. Shane, hi. Are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Yes, you play the lottery, Shane.
Yes, I do play the lottery, but not as much as I used to.
Uh-huh. Have you won it big or a little bit?
No, I just have a quick quick analogy of what happened to me. I, after years of playing Powerball, I finally hit 4 out of 6. I got very excited and went to the store and then found out that 4 out of 6 on the Powerball is only $100. You know, I was very dejected after playing for, 10, 15 years, and then I stopped playing for a while. And I would ask Mary, and without trying to sound communist, Mary, and not trying to be negative, why does one ticket have to be worth $200 million when, when $1 million would be life-changing, I'm sure, for any middle-class Iowan? Why couldn't there be $200
million? Right. Good question, Shane. Why this breakdown, the big winners, and then why couldn't we have more so million-dollar winners, I guess, is the question, Mary.
That is a great question, and it's something that we get from people quite often, particularly about the Powerball game. I can tell you that the sales in Powerball speak to what people are really doing with the money, and that is they're jumping in when the jackpot is huge. So people may say that they would like, the money to go to 200 different winners as $1 million, but in fact, more people are buying when the jackpot is $200 million, $300 million. So people definitely want to play for that big prize. Having said that, however, we are looking at Powerball and we are looking at our other lotto games to figure out if we can keep that big jackpot in place, because that is something that people want to play for, but also do more to really encourage what we would call a shower of millionaires, where you can also have some significant but not quite as big prizes in the game. We've already made some changes in that regard. If you do Powerball with the Power Play, you can win $1 million, and we've had 15 people of that kind win $1 million since 2008. But we're looking at that game and we're looking at some upcoming lotto games to try to put that in place, because that is something that people want to see. Everybody wants the chance to win. Some people really want to win big. Depends on your perspective.
What are your chances of winning the Iowa lottery?
Well, it depends on what game you play. Obviously, Powerball has long odds, and everybody knows that. It takes long odds to produce those big jackpots. In some of our scratch games, the odds are very good. In the $100,000 cash game, which is an in-state lotto game, the odds are much better than Powerball. So it really depends on the product that you're playing. In a scratch game, the odds can be, overall odds can be as low as, 1 in 3. In Powerball, the odds of winning the jackpot obviously are extremely long. It's 1 in 195 million. But it has to be that way if you want to produce the big jackpots that you see today.
Okay, Mike is with us from Maquoketa. Hi, Mike. We're coming to the end of our time with Mary Neubauer. What have you got for us?
I was just curious, what kind of preventative measures do they take to prevent convenience store clerks from playing the lottery? That's why I don't buy them anymore, because I know there's a convenience store in Maquoketa where the clerks play the lottery, and I don't think that's fair.
That the clerks, because their store is benefiting from it? Is that what
as they're working, they're pulling off 5 tickets, whatever, scratching them, and then paying for their ticket. That doesn't seem fair to me that they can do that.
Okay, let's let Mary address this concern.
right.
Another great question. Thank you, Mike, for calling. You know, here in Iowa, some people are prevented from playing the lottery. Ben, when you were leading into the last segment, you were asking, do you play the lottery? And my answer is, no, I can't. I'm prevented by law from doing that. So obviously, if you work at the lottery, you can't play there because we do have the inside information on, you know, the statistics in the games and the modeling of the games and things like that. If you work at a convenience store or at a retail location that sells lottery tickets, however, you don't have a greater advantage than the public. You don't go into the planning of the games. You don't know which tickets are winners, which tickets aren't winners. You don't have that inside information. So, indeed, it is okay for clerks and for retail employees to play. Now, some locations do have rules that say their workers shouldn't be playing when they're on the job. That is something that's up to the individual business to put in place because, again, those are their employees. But from the general public's perspective, the person who works at the store doesn't have any advantage over you as a member of the public because they don't work for the lottery and they can't do anything to affect the outcome of the tickets that are there in the store.
Mary Neubauer, we have just 3 minutes left. I want to touch on a couple of items, the future prospects for the lottery. But before that, I want to touch on touch play. It took four mm-hmm. years, but finally Iowa has closed the book on touch play. To remind our listeners, it was a slot machine-like game that produced good revenue, but ultimately the Iowa legislature voted to ban it. And on a date last month, $150,000 claim was upheld against the Iowa Lottery and State in a lawsuit that followed this ban. What lessons have been learned by the Iowa Lottery in connection with touch play?
Well, I think the lesson wouldn't apply just to the Iowa Lottery, but to the public as a whole, to the legislature, to the governor's office, to generally anyone who would be involved in the conversation. And that is, you know, what is socially acceptable? That's the concentration that we all have to take away from any form of entertainment that we might be considering here in Iowa is what is the level of social acceptability? You know, obviously people want to gamble. They do gamble here in Iowa, but what are you willing to accept and in what locations? That's probably one of the answers. The other answer, though, is that obviously these are tough economic times. People are looking for money. So what forms of new socially acceptable entertainment can be introduced to continue to provide the revenues that valuable programs so desperately need?
Mm-hmm. How has the lottery done in the recent challenging economic times?
You know, interestingly, the lottery has continued to do really well. There are some other forms of gaming that are down, but in the lottery's latest year, we had record sales. And I think it's because lottery tickets remain today what they were in 1985, a convenient local form of entertainment that is available all across the state. So it's easy for people to play. People like to play it. You know, and we continue to look at our game lineups and to look at new ideas to make sure that we do remain a strong source of revenue, because that was one of the main reasons that the lottery was started.
Are you planning to introduce something new in the new session of the legislature that would add to your menu on the Iowa Lottery?
You know, I don't think we are going to be looking at legislation, but lotteries across the country here in the United States are looking at starting a new lotto game next year that will probably be another big jackpot kind of a game, but would have that concentration on a shower of millionaires as well that we were talking about earlier in this session. And then actually some legislation that's currently pending in Congress has everyone in the gaming industry as a whole watching. Congressman Barney Frank just passed a bill in the House Financial Services Committee last week to allow for the regulation and taxation of internet gambling in this country. It would be a big change in the gambling landscape, and it's something that everyone needs to be aware of and to continue watching to see what that will do to the horizon for all of us.
Very quickly, in a negative way or positive way, that impact the internet gambling?
I think it could be both negative and positive. People already are doing it. There's no question about that. And the impact from on the financial side is huge. But if you're going to be talking about that, you have to make sure that you have age verification in place and that you have safeguards in place to prevent people from overspending, because that is a big concern when you're talking about internet gaming, something people might be doing at home. That's something that people are going to continue to talk about, I know, as that legislation moves forward.
Mary Neubauer, thank you very much. Of Iowa Lottery. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. I appreciate your time.
And when we come back here on The Exchange, a little salsa on the prairie We'll look at a documentary film that has renewed interest as the hot topic of immigration in Arizona has gone into the headlines. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us for The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll get the latest on the debate over GMOs. Recently, perhaps you heard the news, the European Union freed its member states to make their own decisions on whether to grow genetically modified crops. Tomorrow on our program, we'll talk with James McWilliams, author of the new book, Just Food. In it, he argues in favor of GMOs on the basis they could benefit the environment. Tomorrow, we'll also hear arguments against GMOs from Jeffrey Smith, author of Genetic Roulette, Science and the Politics of Genetically Modified Crops, tomorrow on this program. And immigration is, of course, a hot topic in Arizona and other states around the country. A film that focuses on the impact of immigration in one Iowa community premiered this month on the documentary channel, on Sunday, as a matter of fact. It's called A Little Salsa on the Prairie, The Changing Character of Perry, Iowa. The film looks at the influx of Latinos into this small town in central Iowa and the immigration-related issues that have gained much attention in the national media. The film has had more than 30 screenings in Iowa, California, and New York. It has also been shown on Iowa Public Television. Here's an excerpt from the film. It surveys some of the attitudes surrounding the influx of Latinos to Perry, Iowa, beginning in the early 1990s.
You know, when I got here to Perry, and people would look at me, they thought, oh, you know, she doesn't understand English. You know, she's Spanish-speaking. She doesn't understand. But not knowing that, you know, I did speak English, and I am an American. And I've had to have proved myself not only once but twice, because I have to prove myself not only to my own people but to the Anglo population too.
That attitude was kind of, they look, it was kind of suspicious, you know. There was no hatred, not at all, but there was a lot of unknown.
The attitude of the older workers, they had really hostile attitudes toward a lot of Hispanics. They thought they were almost stealing their jobs.
I remember feel afraid to answer the door or to answer the telephone because I was not available or I was not able to speak the language, and I was afraid.
Little excerpt from A Little Salsa on the Prairie, The Changing Character of Perry, Iowa, a documentary film premiering this month on the documentary channel. Joining us now, the writer and co-producer of that film, Drake English professor Jody Swilke. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Ben.
And Kent Newman joining us as well, co-producer and an independent filmmaker. Kent, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Let me turn to Jody. First of all, a lot of communities in Iowa and in the U.S. saw an influx of Latinos. Why did you decide to focus on Perry, Iowa? What made it so attractive for a documentary film?
Well, Perry itself was a community that was within reach of where I lived, and it had gone through some of the classic changes that other communities throughout the state had gone through. But at the same time, it was somewhat unique in that there was a concerted effort in the town of the community to define itself as a community that celebrated immigration.
Mm. And what set off the immigration to Perry? Some history, some background there. In the early 1990s, what happened?
Well, as what happened across Iowa and many places throughout the Midwest, changes in the meatpacking industry, which drove out the more unionized, worker-oriented shops, brought about pressure on looking for new workers. Wages went down, and a company called IBP took over many of the plants, and it actively solicited workers in initially in Southern California, and East Los Angeles, Texas, and Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Kent Newman, what did you set out to do in this film?
Well, I had been involved in a humanitarian community development project in El Salvador since the mid-90s, and I was familiar with what we call the economic push-pull factors that result in people needing to immigrate from Central America, from Latin American countries, because the economy is so depressed. They often have family members here, but it's also very difficult to immigrate legally, because El Salvador, for instance, the U.S. Embassy only approves about 3% of the visa applications. So it's not dishonorable there to find a coyote to try to travel north to join your family where you might have a job waiting for you. And like Jody, you know, I was interested in this issue. I'd been started shooting some footage along the Mexico-Arizona border in 2004, basically just to support the thesis that for a variety of reasons, there's a need to reform our immigration laws.
Is this one of the reasons you think the documentary channel picked up on this and has premiered it on Sunday and will air it a number of times this month and on into September, I believe? You can find out the listings for those airings at documentarychannel.com. The renewed interest in immigration, the Arizona immigration law, the contentious law there, is that something that has pulled this interest in this type of film up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, again, I think Jody and I both, one of the reasons for making the film, this was in our backyard. It was not far for us, you know, both living in Des Moines. But once again, there has been no change in our immigration laws, our rules and regulations. There's been lots of dialogue over the last 5 or 6 years, but there's been no substantive action. Meanwhile, you have states like Arizona enacting what's been viewed as a, you know, potentially very discriminatory law, a lot very controversial, and it's going to be, again, you know, continuing court battles here to see whether states' rights can prevail in this case or not.
I want to take a listen to another excerpt in just a moment, but I want to reach out to our listeners and ask, what are your thoughts on immigration in Iowa? How has it changed our state, our culture? Perhaps you are an immigrant to Iowa. Tell us about your experience. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Another excerpt from this film, titled A Little Salsa on the Prairie, The Changing Character of Perry, Iowa, made in 2007. Here's a little section that has excerpts from interviews with Latinos who immigrated to Perry.
When we came here at the beginning, we feel like strangers.
In California, I considered myself one of the nerdy kids where I hung out with all the nerds or I liked school. But coming here, I think a lot of kids had the perception that we're gangbangers, we're thugs.
When I first came to high school, I felt, like I said, I felt different. I felt that I was different from anyone else, from everyone else. Because I was a minority, because I didn't know the language, because I dressed different, because I looked different.
An excerpt from A Little Salsa on the Prairie, the documentary film. I want to ask you, Jody Swilke, as the writer and co-producer of this film, in interviewing the Latino population of Perry, Iowa, what surprised you? What did you learn from that experience that you didn't know going into it?
Well, I think what I learned the most about people is that we all come in with prejudgments and conceptions of who everybody around us is. Like, for instance, I would have thought from the beginning, because I use the term Latino, that most of the people in Perry that I would, from the Latino community, would have used that term, but they would, most of them use the term Hispanic. And I think that that carries over deeply into the perceptions people have of the other, of the new person, of the person that they're not familiar with. Like at the beginning, your first clip shows, I think, demonstrates this very well, or illustrates it very well. Vivian D. Gonzalez, who opens the film, talks about how she was perceived, that she was Spanish-speaking. She was born in the United States. She was bilingual, but she was already perceived to be a certain way. And the person who follows her, John Palmer, who had been in meatpacking, said he was suspicious right away. So I think how that carries over into all of us in different levels, that's what I think people enlightened me on.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of the experience of the previous residents, the current residents who existed there also before the influx of immigration there. Here's an excerpt with some of the opinions of the white residents of Perry, their reaction to the influx of Latinos captured in this film, A Little Salsa on the Prairie.
There was no ordinance against anybody parking a car in their front yard because that was never an issue. It never happened and it was never a problem. Well, folks from different cultures, that was their property, that was a place to park, and so they did that.
I vividly remember the day that a family came in and they had a first grade student that did not speak any English and was Latino. We both struggled because of the obvious, and that was communication. How can we say what we want the student to do, and how can we listen to the student when they have particular needs?
I think a lot of people felt like they're taking over Second Street, and that's been our street for all these years. And all of a sudden there's a restaurant, there's a store, and they rented the apartments above it, so they were always running around Second Street. I think that was a shock to some people.
Even there were situations, like I said, where people in government, after you hear those things, or people hear all the negatives, to a degree you pick up some of those things too. It's kind of like the us versus they philosophy.
You have a group of people who are very welcoming, and then you have the people who are, they're not unfriendly, but then you hear the things like, well, they certainly should learn how to speak our language. Well, look at how they do it. I mean, that's not the way we do it here.
It's an excerpt from A Little Salsa on the Prairie, premiering this month on the Documentary Channel. Our filmmakers, Jody Swilke, the writer and co-producer of the film, independent filmmaker Kent Newman with us, co-producer of the film. Join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. Or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. These specific comments, something like you think the neighbor starts parking his or her car on the lawn. Now, what is that harm actually? But it can get some people's backs up. Did you have trouble, Kent Newman? Let me go to you this time. Getting people to open up about their prejudices, even if they were little ones, like we don't park cars on lawns in Perry, Iowa.
Well, yes, and it actually went, a little bit deeper than that. And you see that in kind of the story within the story in our film is the community dialogue process that we promoted in Spanish and English using a process called study circles. There were several groups, several English language groups. There was a Spanish language group and two groups at the high school, one in Spanish and one in English. And they all had trained facilitators, used the discussion guide provided by the Study Circles Resource Center about immigration and culture change and the future of their community. It wasn't, and each of those groups met four or five times. And often it wasn't until the final meeting where people finally were getting honest with each other to express how they felt about it. There were a few Anglo people who said, what bothered them was illegal immigrants and nothing being done about it. Others saying, well, I don't think that's really the issue in our community. So I think it is challenging to get people to express their point of view. We also found out that a lot of Anglos who were not comfortable with the changing nature of their community actually moved away from Perry.
Mm.
They just said, if this was a great place to grow up, but I don't like it the way it is now, and I'm going to find someplace else to live.
What lessons would you say does this experience of Perry, Iowa, have for the rest of the state, for the rest of the country? Jody Swilke.
Well, I think what Perry teaches us is that it's a pretty generally welcoming community. It hasn't had some of the same complications that other communities have had. At the same time, I think that it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of commitment to any sort of change, to accepting people who are bringing different cultures. At the same time, I think it teaches us to look at how the new people, the new arrivals, are enhancing the community, how they're buying houses, how they're bringing families to town, how they're increasing the population. One of the factors that Kent brought up was the dip in the population for the first time in 1990. It was this reaction to move away, but since then, Perry's population continues to rise because of the settling of Latinos.
Let's go to our callers quickly before the hour ends. David joining us from Marion. Hi, David. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good afternoon. Well, my comment was merely general, not so much as to Perry and Iowa, but I was originally an illegal immigrant, and I was kicked out by the government, and I found a way to legally come back and live in this country. And my main complaint is about illegal immigrants who continue to think they have a right to be here, even though they're breaking the law. And a suggestion would be, when I lived in Germany, there were lots of Italian and Turkish immigrant workers who were allowed to stay for a certain time, then they had to go back to their country for a certain amount of time, and then they could reapply to come back and work in the country once more, and after that, they would be given the opportunity to apply for German citizenship. So I wondered if, you know, that couldn't be an idea to sort of, you know, recycle workers every few years and give them an opportunity to work here, go back home, and decide whether they wanted to come back again, but legally.
Interesting comment, David. Thank you for that from Marion. Let's get a reaction to that. Jody, Kent, any reaction to that comment?
Well, that's been certainly one of the options that people have discussed here as well. I think one of the key differences is that in the European Union, these countries are sometimes share adjacent borders. They're not very far apart. Here, it's a little bit different. I mean, if you've come here from Mexico, you can drive a car home, actually even Central America, but it is a lot further. We're talking about, you know, much greater distances, much more difficulty in traveling, and often, I guess, families who have been here for a length of time, and if they've had children born in this country, those children are legal citizens. So, you know, every nation, I think, has some unique issues and perspectives, and certainly legal precedent. You know, here in this country, if you go back to the Braceros programs of the started in the 1940s, this was a way of bringing primarily Mexican workers here for specific, usually agricultural jobs, and that really has continued. I think most of the rural areas in this country, like Perry, where we've seen this kind of rapid ethnic diversification, especially from Latino immigrant workers, is because there are jobs available, and often because of the changes Jody talked about earlier, they're jobs that aren't very, that are no longer as attractive to the indigenous population. There's still a lot of controversy about it, but I think it's pretty clear that Latino workers have become a very important part of our economy today.
I would just add to that that part of the situation that's happened over the last 20 years has to do not just with individual industries, but has to do with national interrelations between countries. NAFTA had a big effect on what was going on in the 90s. And I think you have to look at the layers of this and not think that one program, and that's why we've had so much trouble with a comprehensive immigration legislation.
Yes. Let's go to Jackie in Coon Rapids. Jackie, good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Yes, I had the experience of working in Perry as a public health nurse, and I found that when I reached out to the Latino community, it made many people uncomfortable and others not. I think that in America there are, and I think across the world, you have good and bad people from any culture, and what happened was that there was just a poor reporting of the good of the Latino community. I felt that they were really trying and working very hard to become productive members of the society, and I ended up ultimately leaving the occupation, but I was really glad to have the experience.
When you were doing this, working as a health nurse there, Jackie, in what light were you seen in as suspicious by the Latino?
Not suspicious. No, I wouldn't say suspicious.
Discomfort.
Discomfort.
What was the source of that discomfort?
it's hard to articulate. I would like to say that it is just change. Change is scary. But there was a certain exacerbation of the bad element of some of the behavior of the immigrants that caused more suspicion. And you said suspicion, but it is that way.
Hmm. Okay, Jackie, thank you for sharing your experience from Coon Rapids. Let's go to Cedar Rapids with Mike. Hi, Mike. Just a couple minutes left on our program. What do you have to share with us? Mike, are you still there from Cedar Rapids? Shirley from Perry, Perry, Iowa. Shirley, hi.
Hi. And hello to Kent and Jody. That was an interesting experience when Kent and Jody were in the community working on that documentary. I was peripherally involved. I wanted to share with the listening audience that one of the women interviewed in the film, one of the Hispanic women who said she was very afraid when she first moved here, that woman is now very bilingual and very involved in the community. And it's been, for me, who I've lived here 20 years, it's been very heartwarming to see how many of the new families have become so well integrated in the community.
That was my question. We have just a few seconds left. Shirley, how would you characterize the integration of the new immigrants into Perry's landscape these days? Very quickly.
I'd say it's going very well, much better than it was 20 years ago. I mean, we still have strides to make, and there are new families coming in all the time, and the language barrier is probably the biggest barrier. The families, the people who do not speak English tend to isolate and just interact with other Spanish-speaking individuals until they can learn the language.
Shirley, we have to go. Thank you very much. Shirley from Perry, Iowa, talking today, this half hour, with Jody Swilkey, Kent Newman. They produced, co-producers of the film A Little Salsa on the Prairie, The Changing Character of Perry, Iowa, premiering this month on the Documentary Channel. Find out more about its future airings at thedocumentarychannel.com. Jody Swilkey, Kent Newman, thank you for joining us to talk about your film.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.